So thank you very much, Lars, for the very kind introduction. And also, I should thank the KITP for the invitation, of course, and you for coming, because I know this is a Wednesday evening, and there are other maybe more entertaining things for you to do, like watch the debate. I think I've heard there was a debate today, but I really appreciate that you are all here. So I am one of the co-organizers of the program SEEDS, where we study essentially the physics of how thin things fold, bend, crumble, and all that. But today, I will talk to you about something entirely different, which is the physics of networks, which is another big topic I'm working on. But before I get into the details, some acknowledgments, the people that I would like to thank, my students, my various other collaborators, the funding, and of course, KITP for all their support and logistic support, monetary support, and for actually putting this program together and allowing it to happen. But let's get started. Oh, yeah. Maybe this is a bit better. Good. Let's see. Is this better? Good. Okay. So we live in a highly interconnected world. Our lives are permeated by highly complex and frequently very, very large networks. One is the road network. I'm sure most of you came here by car, so you got to experience that. Another is the airport connectivity network. You can basically go from one point in the world to another point by hopping from airport to airport. The World Wide Web, I'm not going to say anything else about that. Forensic networks and Facebook, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. So all these networks are very, very, very well studied, and we know a lot about them, their dynamics, their physics. But you don't need to go far to you don't need to go far further than your own bodies to find a very, very interesting complex network, and that is our own vasculature, the arteries and the veins that permeate our body and connect every millimeter of our body to every other millimeter of our body. Now, just some fun facts about the vascular network. If I were to cut up the veins and arteries of our bodies and put them in a single line, that line would go around the globe twice. We have a tremendous amount of veins in our body. Now, their diameter varies from about an inch to something which is less than one-tenth of the human hair. So we're talking about many orders of magnitude in size. And all this vascular network can hold up to 5 liters of blood. So we're talking about an immensely large and complex system. So what does the system do? That system is necessary to transport oxygen from our lungs to the rest of our system and nutrients wherever they're needed. Now, what do we actually need a vascular system to do that? We need it because diffusion is not enough. Diffusion, which is basically a process that just relies on randomness to transfer things around, is very, very slow. So if you look up the diffusion coefficient for oxygen in water, you can, in the back of the envelope, calculate that in order for an oxygen molecule to travel 10 micrometers, which is about the diameter of a cell, you would need about 30 nanoseconds. That's super fast, no problem. If that molecule had to travel 100 micrometers, that would take about 3 seconds. If that molecule had to travel 1 millimeter, that would take 5 minutes. So the time it takes for things to diffuse explodes as the distances get larger. That means that diffusion is okay if you have to transport things inside one cell. A cell doesn't need a vascular system. It is almost okay if you want to transfer things inside a worm, a nematode, which is about 1 millimeter long. But it's not okay for anything larger than a nematode like this cute mouse. The mouse and everything larger than a worm basically needs a vascular system. And in fact, our vascular systems have to be very, very dense. Typically, the distance between capillaries are about 40 micrometer, so that this would allow the oxygen and other nutrients to diffuse fast. Now, we are not the first generation to be fascinated by vascular systems. In fact, humans have always been fascinated by them. But one of the first people to study them after the Dark Ages was Leonardo da Vinci. So at the time, the Catholic Church was not okay with cutting people up when they died and studied them anatomically. So he went and befriended a person who was dying in hospice, and he got his permission to actually study him after he died. And this is how Da Vinci was able to do these very nice anatomical drawings. So he was very interested in the vascular system of humans, but he was also very interested in plants. And one of the things that he figured out are the scaling relationships between the trunk of a tree and its branches. And he figured out a law, a scaling law, that tells how that tree branches bifurcate. And he had some basic understanding of maybe why this law should be that, but in general, he did not understand very well why transport systems should look the way they do. A very, very big leap in our understanding why vascular systems look the way they do happened actually fairly recently in the grand scheme of things in 1926 in the work of Cecil Murray from the Bryn Mawr College in Pennsylvania, where basically he wondered, okay, so let's think about the human vascular system. The heart needs to use energy to pump the blood, because as the blood is flowing through the veins and arteries, there is dissipation. So the blood slows down. So the heart needs to pump it to make it go. So how should I design a vascular network to minimize that the energy that is being wasted? So keeping that mathematical principle in mind, he came up with this law that has been verified for many systems. And this law says that the cube of the radius of the mother vessel is equal to the sum of the cubes of the radii of the daughter vessel. So every time you have a bifurcation, trifurcation, whatnot, this rule should hold. So this is a rule that can be derived from an optimality principle, from a principle that tells the vascular network needs to be good at this, and has been found to hold. Now, similar rules that are based on optimality principles have been found to hold for both in plants and animals for several systems. So now we'll talk to you about a system that is very near to my heart, and that is the transport system in a plant, and in this example, in a tree. So like us, plants need a vascular system, and they actually have two of them, the xylem and the phloem. The xylem is there to transfer water in the plant, because the plant can only pick up water in the roots, and it loses water in the leaves through transpiration. So the plant picks up water, and it has this network of xylem vessels, and it brings up the water to the canopy, and then the water is lost through transpiration. Now, this sounds easy when I say it, but it's actually insanely hard. The tree doesn't have a pump right here to push the water up. In fact, the reason this happens is through capillary action. So basically, the water is being pulled from the leaf. So the water column that is established from the roots to the leaves is under negative pressure, and it's very—it's prone to cavitation. It's prone to breaking, the same way something would break if you pull it. So the plant needs to have a very efficient transport network so that it minimizes resistance to the flow. Now, to get an intuitive feeling of how hard and how amazing this process is, just go up in a tall ladder and get a really, really, really long straw and try to suck up water from a glass of water, and then you will see how amazing this process is. Now, once the water reaches the leaf, it's lost through the stomata. Now, in order for the leaf to photosynthesize, it needs to exchange gases with the atmosphere. So it has these little openings at the bottom, which are called the stomata, and when the leaf is photosynthesizing, the stomata are open and gases come in and out, and accidentally water is lost. And in fact, this process is extremely wasteful. For every molecule of carbon that is being captured, hundreds of molecules of water are being lost. And if the leaf starts getting very, very dry, the plant can sense it and it closes the stomata. But if the stomata are closed, photosynthesis can't happen. Now, the leaf knows that, and it has this beautiful vascular system that replenishes the water that is lost through transpiration. And if the system is very efficient, it can bring a lot of water, waste accidentally a lot of it, and be able at the same time to photosynthesize, make a lot of sugars, and grow fast, which is good. So photosynthetic efficiency, which is very important for the leaf, is limited by water potential at the leaf. So we have established that the transport system, the water transport system in the leaf is very important. So let's look at it. Now you see, this is the leaf blade. This leaf is actually a sample which is about, in reality, this long, just to give you some perspective. Now, if you look at it cursorily, you see something that looks like a tree. But if you zoom in, you see lots of loops. You zoom in a little bit more, you see even more loops. You see loops within loops within loops. In fact, this whole structure is permeated by loops. And these loops do not look all the same. There are many, many distinct venation types. In some cases, the loops look more flat, I would say, non-hierarchical. In other cases, they look more organized. Here you have these long parallel veins. So you have many phenotypes, as we'd like to call them. So in the next few slides, I will discuss with you some tools we have come up in order to be able to quantify all these rich phenotypes that we see in the leaf venation. So how do we do that? We take this sample and we digitize it, and then somehow we have to tell to allow the computer to process it. So we have some programs that turn this, let's say, JPEG image, this bitmap image, into a collection of nodes and links that the computer can understand. And then we go and we measure things. The first things that we can measure are local things that one could easily measure with a ruler. Basically, we can measure vein density. We can measure average vein thickness. We can measure average area of the loops and things like that. But there are other things that cannot be easily measured with a ruler, and these are the topological properties of the leaf. Now, what is topology? For our purposes, topology is something which is not insanely complex. In fact, it tells us topology, the topological properties of the leaf, are the properties that tell us how the various edges that make up the leaf vascular network are connected and where they rank in their thickness. Now, all these networks that look very, very, very different, because let's say I started with this network, I jiggled the nodes here, keeping the connectivity the same. Here I made everything proportionally thicker, here I squashed it. All of these have the same topological properties because the connectivity remained the same. So they look very different to the eye, but there's something fundamentally the same in all these guys. Yes. Yes. So this is one network. I took this one with a computer and I just squashed it. So the only thing that changed here is the position of the nodes, but the connectivity didn't change. If I were to start from this node at the bottom and made a path in the network following, let's say this is the thickest one, let's say, this is the second thickest and so on and so forth, if I follow the prescribed path here would be the same, it's just the distances would change. What I did here is I just jiggled the nodes. So I took this one and I moved it a little bit down, I took this one, I moved it a little bit up, so just this area looks bigger here than here, but the connectivity is the same. So it's like taking this network and moving the nodes around. In this particular case, I just made everything thicker by the same proportion. I know they look very different by eye, but the only thing that stays the same here is the connectivity, and that are the topological properties. So another example where you can see maybe what I mean is if you look at these networks here that have the same geometrical network, the same geometrical properties, meaning the following. All the nodes are in the same position relative to each other. They're all a square grid, square grid, square grid, square grid, square grid. If I were to calculate the average edge thickness, if I were to sum up the weights of the edges here, or even the distribution of the edges here, 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 and here, I would have the same distribution. If I were to measure the angles between the edges, it would be the same. And a lot of the geometrical things I could measure would be the same. However, by eye, you can tell that they're all very different. But these things here would not be able to capture the fact that these things are different. And let's see how they're different. This one looks very hierarchical, very nested, like by eye you look, this is a thick loop, and then inside it there are thin loops, and so on and so forth. This is even, I would say, to abuse the word fractal, like it looks self-similar. This looks very nested, like this one, but this one has long veins, you see these long strands, and this one doesn't. These veins are broken. This vein tries to go up. This is broken. It continues here, but this doesn't have these very long veins. This one has long veins. You can see them easily, but it doesn't have this nested property. It doesn't have nested loops. It has loops, but they're not hierarchically nested. And this one is very random. So we have made some tools to actually quantify, put numbers into this property that your eye can easily capture. If you saw this, you would immediately tell me, this is very different than this, this looks random, oh, but this looks, probably you would say, nested. So we have made mathematical tools to actually quantify, put numbers here. And with our ability to measure these numbers, we can now go and look at many leaves, 200 samples, some of which you saw in the slide, so in the beginning, digitize them and actually measure their topological properties. And in this graph right here, whatever is in this topological corner, in this corner looks topologically the same as this. Whatever is in this corner looks topologically the same as this. And remember, when I say topologically, I mean the actual leaf can look very, very different, but I'm actually measuring something which the eye might not be able to see immediately. You see, all these have the same topological properties. So here, these leaves are statistically, let's say, equivalent to this. And right here, if I had any leaves, they would look like this. Now, you see, I've marked this sample and this sample as their closest neighbors. So let's see what they look like. Up here, I have something which is very hierarchically ordered, this sample here, Proteum grandifolium, and its closest neighbor is Proteum cuneatum. And you see, they look very similar even by eye. So this method of measuring the topology can pick up things that, in this particular case, your eye could also pick up. This is not necessarily true in all cases. Now let's look at this guy, which is further down. Now, as I said, if you're further down, you're not as strongly nested. And indeed, these two samples look like this. This looks more random. Not as bad as this, but definitely not as strongly nested as this. So with this particular tool, we can actually define something which is akin to a fingerprint. Like when you're measuring, when you want to identify a human, you can measure their weight, you can measure their height, you can measure their hair color, but maybe you don't have to do all that. Maybe you have to actually measure something very, very small and local about them, which is their fingerprints, and maybe that's enough to identify them. So we've been testing this method, and we've testing to see whether these measurements are enough to give us something like a plant fingerprint. And to some extent, they do. There is a lot of information hidden here. Now, I've told you how hierarchically nested loops are a distinctive feature of leaf vasculature. Now, the question is, why would we have loops in the first place, right? Why is it, it's not really entirely obvious why these networks need to have loops. So we're going to discuss that. In fact, loops are not strictly necessary, but as I will show you, they're good for the leaf. Now, the very, very primitive plant species did not have loops in their venation. In fact, their venation was very boring. Most of the links had the same weight. It's like a ginkgo leaf, as we will see very soon, and they had no loops. And gradually, as we see in the fossil record, we started having loops, no hierarchical organization, just loops. You can see them here. And then after some iterations that I don't show here, we started having this beautiful hierarchically nested pattern. And in fact, these guys have all but taken over the planet. You go outside, you pick a leaf at random. If it's not a conifer, chances are it's more or less going to look like this. In fact, even ferns, completely phylogenetically disconnected species, they've independently evolved very similar patterns. Now, why do we need loops? The first approximation is kind of easy to see. Now, if I were to make even the smallest damage in a network that has a tree topology, and let's say this is the root of the tree, this is the petiole of the leaf, and I try to put water, to pull water in, to draw water in the network, right here, I wouldn't be able to send anything to a really big sector. So trees are very sensitive to damage. Very sensitive. And let's do this little demonstration for a real ginkgo leaf. By the way, ginkgos, they used to be all over the planet. Like North America was full of ginkgos, but as soon as angiosperms, the plants with the fancy venation I showed, evolved, they displaced ginkgos because they were much better in doing many things. And one of the things that they did better was they were more productive photosynthesizers. So I punch a hole in this leaf, and you see everything downstream from this hole cannot get water, in this case fluorescent dye, and it will die. Now this is a modern leaf. This is a lemon leaf. I punch a hole here, and you see how beautifully the water uses the loops to hydrate the whole leaf blade and the rest of the leaf. You know, this is a major damage, but the leaf is going to be okay. Now, in this example, it's more counterintuitive because when you first see it, you see the primary veins. This is a monocot, so the venation is dominated by parallel veins. Now, you see that the network has these higher order veins that are not visible with the naked eye that are being used, and actually this vein fills up almost magically. So modern plants have loops. Now, okay, I've convinced you, it's kind of obvious you're going to tell me, but of course, if you need robustness to damage, you need loops. But there are many ways I can put the loops in. I have this tree network, I can connect all the terminal nodes of this tree, and there I am. This would work. But also, this would work, which looks very different. So which is better? In order to answer this question, we need a computer. And the equations that govern the flow of the network are very similar to the equations of a resistor network. I'm not showing them, but if you remember how to solve Kirchhoff network in school, it's basically a one-to-one mapping. In this particular implementation, we fix the source and the net currents. In this particular case, the source of the water is the petiole, and then every node in the network is a sink where water is lost through transpiration. And then we also fix the cost to build the network. Because imagine if I was in a city and I needed to build a system to deliver water from the aqueduct to the houses. If I had infinitely many resources, I would have gigantic pipes, no problem. Everybody would be happy, and then they would be able to take a shower on their fifth floor of their house, and the water pressure would be fine. But that's wasteful. So a pipe needs a certain mass to be built. The bigger the pipe, the more mass, but the bigger the pipe, also more conductivity. So keeping this consideration in mind, I'm fixing the cost. I'm saying I have a finite amount of mass. And last, I'm minimizing the average water pressure drop. So I know from other studies that I won't mention that the leaf cares to minimize the water pressure. We saw an example of that when we were looking at the tree that had to suck up the water, but leaves basically care about water pressure. And we put these elements in the computer and we crank the wheel, and the computer spits out something that looks very much like a leaf. I have the primary vein, I have the secondary veins, I have these connections near the edge. So this looks very much like a leaf, and the color is the pressure drop. And then I zoom in, because my computer can't give me very high resolution for the whole network. I zoom in and I can reproduce many features of the leaf. I can reproduce the intersecondaries, which you see here, these veins, even these features right here. And then I can zoom in some more. It's more difficult to see here. So these are two secondary veins, and these are two tertiary veins, and these are the veins that connect them. Now, some of you might tell me, why should I care about leaves, right? Well, a lot of these principles apply almost one-to-one for our own brain, the cortical vasculature. Now, let me tell you just a few words about the cortical vasculature. So just making things a little bit too simple, the vasculature of our brain has three tiers. At the top, we have the surface arterial network, which is full of loops. So these are all arteries, and they have loops. This is very different than what we were told in school, that arteries cannot anastomose with each other. And that thing is connected to the circle of Willis. And from the surface arterial network, we have the penetrating arterioles that come down and feed the subsurface macrovasculature that has a lot of loops. Now, this system is beautifully made. So you have on the surface, you have all these loops. So if a small clot happens, which is very likely, you won't even feel it. The blood is going to bypass the clot, and you're not going to have a big area of the network destroyed. Now, if you have a small clot in the capillaries right here in the microvasculature, again, no problem, lots of loops. The problem actually is here in these penetrating arterioles, that if you have an occlusion, you can lose a whole column. And in fact, this happens. And people think this is one of the causes for age-related dementia. Like if you get one of those, you don't even feel it. But if you are prone to having a lot of occlusions in the penetrating arterioles, you are in trouble. Progressively, more and more and more of the brain is going to be affected. So now the question is, why would we have such a sensitive architecture? Up here, we're robust. Down here, we're robust. But in the middle, we're not. So this is something that people don't really understand in detail, because this is actually a very, very complex system, much more than leaves in many ways. One of the things that we don't understand is actually the fact that in the brain also we have a lot of hemodynamic fluctuations. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that soon. But in the meantime, let's see what I mean by fluctuations. So this is a very simple tree-like network. Let's say the source is here and the sink is here. The water, blood, whatever is mostly going to follow this path. But let's say the network doesn't want to do that the whole time. Maybe the network wants to send load right here. Maybe this is the source and this is the sink. And maybe later this is the source and this is the sink. That means that the load, the sinks are fluctuating. And if I were to optimize the network for this situation where the sinks are fluctuating, that would be different than having all the sinks on at the same time. Very different scenario. Maybe it's a little bit, in some ways, counterintuitive to understand, but it's very different. And going back to the brain, this is a relevant thing to think about because we don't think of the same things the whole time, right? You go running, different parts of your brain are active and you need to send blood there. Then you go and you read a book, different parts of your brain need oxygen, you know, different parts of the network need to be oxygenated. So in the brain, you actually have all fluctuations like that all the time. And in fact, you have them when you're asleep. You have them when you're in deep anesthesia. So how does that affect the structure of the brain? I'm going to go back to the leaf. The leaves do that also. So in the movie that you see here, this is just a little demonstration that we made. And these are the so-called stomatal patchiness. I will skip some of the biology in the interest of time. Essentially, what you see here in this movie, which is about, it loops over, it's about 15 minutes, the whole thing. So it's sped up. But what you see, the dark and the light, are different parts of the leaves that take turns breathing. So you have the dark parts where the leaf is photosynthesizing and losing water. These are the sinks, and then you have the bright parts where the leaf is not photosynthesizing. So that means I have fluctuations in the load in the leaf. So motivated by these two things, we look at fluctuations in the current, and we ask the same optimization question for a network with fluctuations. And what we see is that the more fluctuation we have, the more loops we get, but also, when we change the so-called economy of scale, and by economy of scale I mean I have a small pipe and I have to spend a certain amount of mass to build the wall, and when I make a bigger pipe with more conductivity, I'm not really investing much more to build the wall. It's okay even if I have a thin wall. Right here, when I increase the conductivity, I have to really increase the wall thickness, so I pay a lot of money for the pipe. So as I decrease the economy of scale, as I go to a situation that is not like this, but like this, I get more and more loops. As I increase the fluctuations, more and more loops. So depending on the conditions, I can get, I can see that fluctuations actually induce loops in the network. Now, we've seen in the previous section that loops are a very efficient way to confer robustness against damage and also variability in the load. So loops are good for robustness, but they're also good if you have fluctuations. So you see them all over the place. But how do you build them? How do you make the loops? How does nature actually build the loops? We as engineers, we can do whatever we want, but how does nature do it? Now, there are many, many ways this can happen, but I will discuss one, which is in some ways it's the simplest, but it works like a charm. Now let's look at this following situation. I have this network, you can see it in the background, which is random. It's a very simple network. The source is here, and the sinks are here, the red dots. So I start running current here. This is the source, the current will follow this path. Now the vessels that are used progressively grow. And the vessels that are not used progressively disappeared. This is like a use it or lose it situation. And this is, by the way, why doctors tell you if you don't exercise, you know, your circulation becomes bad. It's not only the heart, it's also a phenomenon like this. So the vessels that are being used grow and the rest will disappear. In fact, this happens even in development. And this is just an example from the tick, essentially. So when the vessels are first assembled, it all looks uniform. But when the heart starts pumping, you start differentiating veins from arteries and you start having hierarchical organization. So it is the flow and it is the measurement of the flow from the network that makes this happen. This can also be a problem, and people that study vascular networks know it, and it has a name. It's called vascular shunting. So let's look at this case. You have a vein here, I'm sorry, a vein here and an artery here, and you have a flow going through this network. With this use it or lose it adaptive rule, if you happen to have just a path that is stronger, more of the flow is going to be diverted there. And these vessels that take most of the flow are going to be used more, and they're going to grow more. It's use it or lose it. So you have an instability. Smaller things are going to disappear, and eventually you're going to end up having a very poor network and no loops. So people have been trying to see how the body corrects that and how the body prevents this vascular shunting from happening. And by the way, in tumors, tumors are very good in altering this, in changing this, because they're biologically very different than the rest of the body. Now, some mathematicians figured out that if I start putting fluctuations here, this bad situation is going to stabilize, and I'm gonna keep having a rich network. So they did it in very small networks. They studied that. So we decided to just see what would happen in a very, very, very large network. So these equations look very complicated, but you don't need to worry about them, because in fact it's very, very simple. The first equation is the equation you know from school. It is Kirchhoff. I'm sure you've all seen it. So the rules that apply in this network and tell us how the flow goes are Kirchhoff. Then you calculate the average current in its vessel. So what happens is that you start with a configuration, and then you consider where the current goes if the source is here and the sink is here. Then you consider what happens if the source moves here and the sink goes there, and et cetera, et cetera. You study all the combinations, and you keep track of how much current on average goes through a vessel. So the vessels kind of remember the average situation. And then, based on that information of the average situation, the vessel will either grow if it's used a lot or shrink if it's not used. So it's quite simple. The network does its thing, there is flow, fluctuations, and then its vessel will gradually grow or shrink depending on whether it's used or not used. So this thing happens for a while, this adaptation. And we observe it in the computer, and what we see is that if we start with a random network, and you see here the color is the, let's say, the importance of the edges, the thickness of the edges, and the dotted red ones is the top 5% of the edges. There are a lot of edges. You see gradually, as the time progresses, this random mess ends up giving me something which is more organized. It has a very well-organized core. So that would be in a way, I don't know if you have been in New York, that would be the system of, let's say, avenues in New York. And these are also connected, the rest of the network is connected to them through the side streets. This would be the small alleys you would have in New York. So the network spontaneously, with this local rule, spontaneously organizes into something which is very hierarchical, and it has a backbone. Another interesting thing is that for this particular situation, the global properties of the network are optimized, like the average shortest path length. So if this was New York and I were to follow the shortest path between each point and each point, this network would be optimal. And if you think about it, it's kind of crazy, because the information that each link had was only local. So each link only measured locally the flow and adapted accordingly, and yet you get to have something which is globally very nice. So this feature has been seen by periodically here and there by several people, and this is actually something wonderful about nature. You can have a local rule giving you properties that are globally optimal for the network. Now, the last thing we did here is we used our methodology to quantify the topology of graphs and put our very complex graphs right here in a plot like this, in the topological phenotype plot that I mentioned earlier. Now the axes are inverted, so up here you have something very organized, and down here you have something very random. And in this plot, you can actually see very well that you start from something random, and then it evolves into something which is very hierarchically organized. So in fact, here we can see that in this instance, the network actually does look like Manhattan. And the interesting part is if we try different adaptation rules, we might get very different distribution of edge weight thicknesses. So here we try two different rules. One rule gives us a very wide distribution. The other one gives us a very narrow distribution. But topologically, these networks are very, very similar. So there is something fundamental about this nested hierarchical organization that we observe, at least, you know, for these parameters. So we've seen in this talk three things. We've seen the what. We've seen that loops and hierarchical nestedness are ubiquitous in biological networks. They're everywhere. Somehow we tend not to notice them and always to look at trees, but in fact, I hope I have convinced you that loops are everywhere. We also saw the why, and we discussed about some optimality principles, robustness and fluctuations, and how this might end up giving us a network that is hierarchically nested. And last, we just looked at one, just one, there might be many, ways that nature can actually make these optimal networks happen, because the why is not enough for nature. This is wishful thinking. Optimality principles is something that would tell us, you know, how the network might function optimally, but it doesn't tell us how nature will find such a solution. So, as I mentioned several times in this talk, the same rules, the same equations, or very, very similar equations, I don't want to oversimplify, would apply for leaves, would apply for slime molds, fungi, and would apply for our own vascular system. All these, as you can see in these pictures, are hierarchical, full of nested loops, but also they have differences. Some of them you can see by eye, others are more subtle. So what are the differences? And what can they tell us about the function? And I will go just a step further, a small step further, and I will say what can we learn by studying these biological transport networks, what can we learn in general about networks that might not be biological in nature. So this is a beautiful kind of esoteric quote by Da Vinci. He mentioned something about gas. It has to do with what people thought about our own vascular system at the time. We can discuss it later, but this is essentially, I will let you read the quote, but this is essentially what he means here. The earth and the human body are both governed by the same physical laws, and for this reason, rivers and veins should share common architectural principles, and in many ways, they actually do. This is something that Da Vinci hinted on, and this is something that Da Vinci realized 500 years ago, and this is something that we should realize today. So with that, I would like to thank my students and collaborators again, and of course you for coming, and KATP for their hospitality.
Tiny steps, I suppose.
Yes.
But how do you describe the energy or the force at work there for each step?
What do you mean by tiny steps? You mean just very slowly, or?
Well, the water is moving in these very fine
structures. Yes. Mm-hmm.
But there has to be an energy that's propelling the water in that one direction, which is up.
Yes.
And how do you describe energy? How is it, where's the energy coming from?
Yes, that's an excellent question. So the, in a way, indirectly, the energy is coming from the sun. So what happens is that right up there in the leaf, right up in the canopy, water is evaporating because the leaf is a flat thing, it's hot, so water is evaporating through the stomata that are very, very, very minuscule. Now, the evaporation of these molecules actually, so these molecules are connected to the rest of the water column. Chemically, in a way, like they are in the same fluid, they're interacting, they want to be with their friends, with the other water molecules, but they're evaporating. So these molecules are being pulled from the top because of the sun, essentially. So that thing pulls the water column slowly upwards because it's a continuous water column that is not broken. So through this cohesion forces, so there is this cohesion tension theory that plant biologists believe that is what I'm trying to describe. So through this cohesion and through this evaporation at the top, the water column is being pulled slowly, slowly up. So if you had a very, 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 very thin pipe, the same phenomenon would happen, but that pipe would have to be very thin because at the top, when the xylem vessel reaches the leaf, it effectively splits up into straws that are a few nanometers large, effectively, which is the path of the water through the mesophyll and the stomata and whatnot. So does this answer the question? And the energy that is being lost is basically the energy through the dissipation through the xylem vessels. Physically, it's the same energy that is being dissipated when you, if you have a straw like parallel to the ground, so you don't have to worry about gravity, and you pull, you suck water through it, through friction, you lose a lot of energy. And that is this?
Okay.
Okay, probably not. Yes. Yeah, I'm not sure what it is, what the siphon effect is. It's
you know, when you start a certain energetic process moving, and then it stays moving for a certain amount of time after the
in this particular. If I were to phrase it in that context, what is really important is that the continuous column, there is a continuous column established that one way or another, that doesn't have any, that is not broken. If that column is broken anywhere, then that process is going to stop. If I were to, if there was a gas bubble in the column, then the whole thing would collapse. So, like, in the same way, if you try to suck water through a straw and somebody punches a hole, in like a tiny hole in the straw, and you have air in it, then you wouldn't be able to pull the water up anymore.
So let me ask you a different question.
Yes.
For many years, I created and taught a course called The Physics of California.
Yes.
Which was natural phenomena.
Yes.
Of course, one other correlation in trees is the diameter of the trunk relative to the height, having to do with buckling of just a column, so the classical physics problem of buckling. But there was also always a debate as to whether the maximum height was set by this physics instead of buckling. Do you know if this physics you're talking about actually impacts the maximum height of the tree?
So I mostly know about leaves, and what I know about leaves is that, well, this is interesting because the size of the leaf actually correlates, because of these principles, because of hydraulic principles, not structure,
yeah,
with the tree size.
Okay.
So the size that you're hydraulically,
yeah,
the leaves are affected. So the smaller, the lower the plant, the larger the variability in the size of the leaves. So you can have small plants that have small leaves, big leaves, no problem. But the height of the tree, in a way, constrains the size of the leaves. So the taller the tree, the more uniform in size the leaves become. So all tall trees have the same size leaves. Now, the competition between structure and flow, I have seen publications claiming to explain the maximum height of the trees, the sequoias, from both sides, and I don't have any working knowledge. I can equally believe both. I don't know.
Yes. Are specific properties of water. Water is kind of a very isotherapy property. If you have something other than water in this process.
Oh, tremendously. And I don't think tremendously. So, for example, again, if I were to make an artificial tree, this is way too complex. Let's make an artificial tree out of PDMS, out of silicon, something. If I had a fluid with a different viscosity, and of course I would have to pull it from the leaves with, if it's not evaporation and transpiration, then something else, then I would have very different dissipation. And I can calculate, just from the dissipation, I can calculate how different I should make the pipes, how much bigger to have an equivalent tree that would run on something that is not water. But then I would also have to worry about what would drive the flow of the water. So,
is water ideal in some sense? Or?
I don't know. That's the only thing we have to work with, actually. I think if the water had, if the water was very different in an alternate universe, then plants would look very different. Yes.
Somewhat like negative pressure is created as the water molecule becomes a gas, as through transpiration there, pulling that molecule.
Yes, so the column, the actual water column, is actually under negative pressure, exactly. So it's, this is because it's being sucked. So effectively, yes, there's a negative pressure. Yes, exactly, absolutely, exactly. And that is about, for tall trees, that could be about, if I remember correctly, 10 atmospheres, minus 10 atmospheres for tall trees. It's tremendous. It is tremendous. It is still a topic which is under debate, how it is possible that the water column is not broken under such tension. It is, the plants are full of wonder. It's negative pressure, yes, exactly.
So what about leaves in water?
Yes, aquatic plants.
Aquatic plants.
Yes, excellent question. So these leaves, it depends. So there are actually species that became land plants and then went back to the water, and these species, it depends on how long they have returned to aquatic environments. They have lost a lot of their xylem, so their xylem has become reduced because they don't need it anymore.
But those that are developed in water, do they show the same vascular structure?
This is something that I try to investigate with a colleague. So we try to do this same. We try to actually study the structure. It's a little bit difficult because it becomes very reduced and it becomes not so strong. A lot of the things that we do for these plants, the land plants, doesn't apply there. It depends on how long it has returned back to the water. Some aspects of it look the same, the reduced vasculature, but you can't. We weren't able to measure it accurately.
Please.
Yes.
What happens at night?
Oh yes. What happens at night is that the plants, like us, go to sleep. The stomata close, and they don't photosynthesize, and they don't lose any water or minimal water. They just, the whole process slows down, / stops. Yes.
If you damage one of those stoma, is there anything on the gas exchange side that would
allow, let's say, to plug up one of the stoma, would another one be able to some way provide?
Compensate? Yeah, I think that's a good question. So they are coupled. If one is open, it affects whether its neighbors are going to be open with various ways, both biochemically and mechanically. Now, whether damage plays an important role there, I'm not sure if there is an active compensatory mechanism. If an area of the stomata for some reason dies, I am not sure that if there exists an active mechanism. But the movie I showed with the fluctuations, this actually happens because the stomata are coupled. Because if one area is closed, the neighbors can sense that that area is closed, and they change their behavior. So the timescales of how this happens leads to this process of fluctuations. So they are affected, but whether there's an active mechanism to compensate, I don't know.
Is the structure of evergreen the same as non-evergreen bulbs? Or is there a difference in the structure?
Statistically, yes. Not always, you know, this is biology. It's very broad range. So one of the most obvious differences is the structure of the leaf. I don't have these examples. Most of the species that you see, most of all these leaves that you see here are tropical species. And what you see is that the secondary veins are connecting near the border. So this is a strong characteristic of species that in like, let's say warm climates. When you go more to the north, let's say Northern Europe, then you have the species that lose their leaves, and the next generation leaves are created in the bud. So they're made and they're protected inside the bud and they're folded. So because of that, because of this folding, frequently they have secondary veins that actually terminate at the border, like this. So they don't do this. They don't do that. So when you see a leaf that terminates like this at the border, and especially when it has a serrated margin, you can bet some money, the likelihood is that this is originally like a northern, a colder climate plant. When you see plants like this, again, don't bet a lot of money, a little bit, because it's not one-to-one. That is mostly for plants that are like warmer climates, like a lemon, for example, or oranges that you have here. They have this connection. And all these things have fancy names that don't matter, but the biological reason is that they grow in the bud, protected. There are also differences in the leaf quality, carbon, nitrogen, that have to do with evergreen versus deciduous. But these are, you can't see them by eye, these differences.
Greg, you started your talk by showing an image of freeways and highways.
Yes.
Have people used any of these ideas from biology and leaves for planning human structures like cities or networks of roads or neighborhoods or subdivisions or urban planning?
Urban planning.
Urban planning. Feedback from the biological world into this?
I would say that so far, no. Let's talk about power grids. So the economical considerations for power grids and the political consideration for power grids actually make it so that there is a lot of resistance to make a very efficient power grid. So things, in a way, are designed to make a certain number of people happy, and they're not for the, they're not globally optimal, let's say.
To make the power company richer.
Yes, and it's very, it's crazy. So I actually have a colleague who is only working on power grids, and we've talked a lot, and some of these principles would actually be applicable to power grids indeed. But so you could actually suggest something, but the chances of that being implemented are close to zero. It's amazing. It's all the resistance. If you go to them and ask them for data, for just data, so that you do a theory, they will just not gonna give it to you. Okay. You have to pay thousands and thousands and thousands to get it. It's proprietary. Oh yes. So we've actually, I didn't talk about it, we've studied it a little bit. So for physicists, it's a wonderful system because, you know, the joke with the spherical cow, it is the equivalent of the spherical cow, it is the one-dimensional network. And in fact, by some colleagues at Harvard, they've studied the xylem network for the conifer needle, which is actually not a network, it's just a single, it's a single line, and they've studied how that line tapers. So, you know, as you go from the root of the needle to the tip, the vein thinness becomes thinner and thinner. And they got, they found a law of how it thins with respect to the length, and that law agrees with what they would expect from optimization principles for the xylem. We did the same for the phloem, and within collaborations with some experimentalists in Europe, and we found again a law that agrees very well with again a tapering law that agrees very well with what you would expect for the optimality principles of the phloem.
Are they still loops
or no? No, they're not loops because it's just it's 1D. You can't make loops. I have to say these plants are much more primitive than these guys. So they're used like ginkgos. They used to be all over the place, but these guys are much more productive. So when they could, they displaced conifers. So now conifers are, have much more reduced habitat than these guys. Yes?
Where do you plan to go with the research after this stage that you're in right now?
That's another very interesting question. So we are trying to understand human vasculature. Mostly like the basic theoretical principles, like what happened in the brain, for example, you have these fluctuations because, you know, you think different things and you have different parts of the brain taking up all the blood. How do you facilitate that, and how do you maybe ensure homeostasis? How do you ensure that you don't just send all the blood at one spot at the same time? And we're also working on the mathematics of three-dimensional networks because these are all 2D. So we're working in understanding how we can apply these methods for three-dimensional networks.